Look up there in the sky. It's a bird, a plane. It's Handsome Boys Comics Hour.
Those boys are so handsome.
One artist.
One weekly discussion of comics and nerd culture. I am your host, Robbie Dorman, the literature geek and writer.
And I'm your other host, Eric Z. Goodnight, professional artist and illustration nerd.
And we are the Handsome Boys Comics Hour, your home for news, reviews, slightly antagonistic banter, and much, much more. I'm just trying to mix up my inflections a little bit.
Trying to inflect your mix-ups. That's good.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
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 Well.
Yeah.
That's
hey guys.
That.
Hey guys. Hey, hey, handsomeites. We're here.
Hey.
I'm back in Florida again.
Back in Florida? Did you ever leave?
I did for a bit. A couple days.
You did for the bit.
For the bit. But I'm back. Talking about comic books again. Again.
Again.
Yet again. Agains. Words.
Mm-hmm.
I save all the good words for Eric.
The extra good, the gooderest words.
Gooderest. There's one of those.
Yeah, totally.
How are you doing, Eric? You enjoying your fruit smoothie?
I enjoyed it. Past tense.
Past tense. It's gone now.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be more.
And all the blender shaking goodness that it entails.
That's the secret to good smoothies.
Yeah, is picking up your blender and shaking it. Don't do that at home.
Results may vary.
Yeah, I have not electrocuted myself yet, nor have I had like a whirling blade of death fly out and stab me in the face yet, but believe me, it's coming.
Maybe we should just get you a new blender instead of you having to shake the one you have.
Nope, death by smoothie. That's all there is.
Okay, it's no choices.
It's my fate. I've resigned myself to it.
So you're like the Cyclops in Krull?
That reference is lost on me. This is a lot of dicking around.
This is back in the good old days.
It is.
When we talk for like 30 minutes and we're like, oh, we have a podcast. We should start that.
Yeah, maybe we should. Maybe we should cut this stuff. Nah. We're charming.
We're charming, right? Yeah. On that note, I think it is time for the Art First segment, which is checking in. Man, that's a good noise.
That's
never get tired of it.
No, I have it playing on repeat while I sleep.
Oh my god. It would drive you insane. Yeah. You'd wake up and you'd be a lunatic.
How do you think I got this way?
You'd be like a light bulb.
It's perfectly normal.
Checking in is a segment where Eric and I talk about what we've been up to during the week. Hey, Eric, what have you been up to during the week?
Fucking nothing. Jesus Christ.
You haven't been up doing nothing. I've been doing Linux. I know that.
And drawing.
I've been looking at your drawings.
Right. I'm going to talk about both of those things, but how many times can one man check in with Linux and Inktober? It turns out every day.
Yeah, all the time, apparently.
Good Lord, no. I liked how you called it Inception Linux.
That's what it is.
Because I'm installing kernel-assisted virtual machines on my Linux server. And the idea is you're creating, you know what a virtual machine is?
Yes.
You can understand the concept.
I understand, yes.
Right. But the thing about kernel-assisted is it uses more of the hardware. Like, you can actually dedicate, like, a core, you know, a processor to it, and you can dedicate so much RAM to it, and it's more effective of a virtual machine than running in VirtualBox, which is just basically a process, you know. There's nothing dedicated to it. But the idea is to dick around and break virtual machines as opposed to break my actual Linux box.
It's a sandbox kind of thing.
Yeah, you can really think of it that way. But it poses its own problems and new things to learn. I mean, it's basically software that it's like enterprise level software that like the people at Red Hat developed to, you know, virtualize things across huge networks. And it's complex and I am dumb. So it's, I don't know. We're going to see. And Inktober. More Inktober. I actually am not going to do my Inktober drawing tonight. I'm going to do it two tomorrow.
Okay.
But as of yesterday, I was all caught up.
You've been pumping them out. They're looking pretty good.
I know. 19 drawings as of this recording. Should have done 20 tonight, but, you know, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
I'll hopefully do 20 and 21 tomorrow night, but I'm nearing my goal of 31 drawings, so I'm feeling pretty good about it. I haven't drawn.
They look great.
You look great.
Well, yeah.
So. What have you been doing?
I have been doing lots of things, but nothing pop culture-y that I can necessarily. I climbed a mountain and married people yesterday.
As in, you did not get married. You performed a marriage ceremony.
I officiated. I said, you know, man and wife, so to speak.
Did you have to get any sort of credentials for that?
I've had them for a long time.
That's really strange.
I've been a minister for a decade now.
That's random. I did not know that. And why would I know that? And why did you do that? Answer me all those questions right now.
What was the first one again?
I don't remember. Just tell me why you're a minister.
Because you can do it online for like 5 minutes.
Well, there you go.
And it's free.
It's free.
Yeah, free.
That's really random.
ulc.org, universallifechurch.org. ulc.org. If you'd like to be an officially registered legal minister, you can do that. ulc.org and do it about 5-10 minutes at most, and it's free.
Wow, that's random.
They've 220 million ordained ministers.
Well, 220 million ordained ministers can't be wrong.
Right, but it's legal enough to marry people, and I did that. My friend, whose name is also Eric, he's one of the Erics.
My
cadre of Eric friends.
Yes.
It's very strange.
Erics.
I have three Erics that are three of my best friends. They're all Erics. It's very strange.
Life is too weird, and you're a minister.
But we were in Georgia. I climbed Stone Mountain, and then I performed a marriage ceremony.
Did you perform a hail to the Confederacy?
I did not do that, even though at Stone Mountain, they have a very kind of...
It's not kind of, it is. It's a fucking monument to Jefferson Davis. One of those guys is Jefferson Davis.
Yes, it's
the president of the Confederacy, for those that didn't follow the war between the states.
Yeah, it's a weird going to this park and monument where it's a really bad Disney World right next to a mountain with very kind of veiled respect to people who, you know,
they
fought for slavery.
Well, they did literally rekindle the flame of the Ku Klux Klan at the top of Stone Mountain. That actually happened.
Oh, good. Makes me feel a lot better about
everything I saw. That happened, and that was in that place. I want to say that it's Grant and Jefferson Davis and some third guy.
Robert E. Lee?
It is Robert Duvall.
Robert Duvall? Well, yeah. He looks like... I think he's been in every Civil War movie that's...
I said Grant, didn't I? I'm the worst Southerner ever.
I don't think getting it wrong is a bad thing when you're...
No, it... They're humans, and it's history. It's okay.
No, it's not. They're terrible people that were terrible. They did terrible things. There's nothing redeeming about them.
Okay.
I don't know. That's the way. I'm just trying to counteract how Stone Mountain is preaching it.
Stone Mountain done to you?
Yeah, they're whatever. But I guess the only thing I can really check in with is Transmetropolitan because I finished it.
That's a good thing. We should book club it at some point.
We should. It's 60 issues though, so we'd have to break it up. But
it's a few.
It's a few.
Ten trades ish.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Okay.
But it's good. It's Warren Ellis writing about Hunter S. Thompson in the future.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Great. I'm not sure I don't have to preach too hard for people to go read Transmetropolitan. But
no.
If you haven't, you should check it out. We will eventually do it in book club. It's a matter of time. It's whenever we feel up to doing a, multiple week reading again after Walking Dead.
Although we did read half of that this week.
Not half. It's 24 issues.
It's 5 books. It's not 6 issues each.
24 issues.
Okay.
24. Like Jack Bauer.
Okay.
Nothing?
I don't care about what's his name.
Kiefer Sutherland?
Yeah. I just want to not remember the name Kiefer.
He's in Lost Boys.
That's good for him.
And Dark City, one of my favorites.
Ew.
What ew? Dark City's great.
I declare checking in over.
I'm just trying to engage you about Kiefer Sutherland, and you just start refusing.
Nope. Do not engage, troll. Nope.
I'm not trolling.
You are a troll.
About Kiefer Sutherland?
You're a Kiefer troll.
I admire the man's work. What is wrong about that?
Nothing. Segment over. Bam.
All right, then. Guess Eric doesn't want to talk about Kiefer Sutherland. I guess we're done with checking in.
That's it for Kiefer talk.
Why are we checking? We talk about mountain climbing and Linux and Kiefer Sutherland.
I'm not a buy on Kiefer Sutherland.
We're going to move on to the floppiest part of the week. The floppiest part, at least, of my week. I don't know about Eric's week.
It gets pretty floppy sometimes.
Yeah, it's hard to say. But it is time for weekly floppies. Man, that noise. Ooh,
there it is again.
There it is again. It just keeps popping in here.
Just a popping.
God, we're stupid.
Well, you are.
Okay, I am stupid. Weekly Floppies is part of the show, Eric, and I read a selection of the week's books, talk about them, tell you to buy or do not buy them, depending if, we like them or not. Or we might just say, meh, and we're not sure. But we try and come down on one side of the fence or the other.
It's important to have an opinion. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. But this week, we are starting off with DC. But this one, we're starting off with Teen Titans number 3, is written by Will Pfeiffer, art by Kenneth Rockefeller, colors by Dan Brown, letters by John J. Hill. We've been following this book so far, at least. We've read the first two for the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still enjoying it. It's keeping my attention.
It kind of gives me like a pit in my stomach. Like I want to like it more than I do. It's not awful. It is dumb as fuck.
Well, yeah. It's Teen Titans.
I know.
Taking on like a robot lady.
I know. I really like her design for some odd reason.
It works pretty well.
Yeah. I want to know how like these kids got melted and then they're fine. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, she used her powers
She used her magic hug.
Yeah.
Okay.
Magic hug. That's, as far as I know, it's all it requires. But yes, the Teen Titans are continuing their fight with this robot AI kind of nano machine construct that has something to do with Star Labs. But it's a nice mixture of levity and kind of action, and they've lightened up a little bit on the whole social media thing.
Mm.
Which was the first issue especially was a little too much on. But they've lightened it up enough to just give it, make it, put it more in the background so it's not overwhelmingly like, look at it. But, you know, they're mixing up the stories. They're, you know, introducing subplots and making it a thoroughly entertaining read.
I don't know if thoroughly is what I'd go for. But
I would say it's thoroughly entertained.
It's you're thoroughly entertained.
Thoroughly entertained. I went.
I think it looks like, I don't know. There's so many like weird things that stick out to me about this. Like the panel with Wonder Girl looks like it's a fucking smartphone commercial. Where she's like flipping her hair and she's drinking coffee. She's like, oh, look at my phone.
Where's that?
What is this page? 18. It's really peculiar. And I can't help but think because have I talked about how one of the lead Android developers said that mobile is dead?
Yeah.
This is gonna look so ridiculous in such a short period of time. Smartphones have blown up so quickly, and I don't know if wearables are even what's beyond that, you know.
I don't replace it.
I think it's going to look really strange. This is going to look, I don't know. Stuff like this is going to look very dated and very like this time period. And I don't know. I may be overly sensitive about that.
I don't think wearables are not replacing cell phones anytime soon. It's not happening.
Okay.
I don't think so. There's too much of stigma about it.
I am pretty sure that someone's going to figure it out.
Regardless of her holding a cell phone does not
No, it's terrible and I hate it. No, this book is
God
just...
God forbid people hold cell phones in comic books.
That is hardly what I'm complaining about. I just think that there's a lot of little weird... I don't even know how to describe it. It's more just a weird feeling I get about this book. It's so strange and abstract. Are you familiar with the word twee?
This book isn't twee.
How are you saying it's not?
Batgirl is twee.
Yeah, it is.
But
this is not far off of it.
This is not nearly as twee as Batgirl is twee. Or Lumberjanes. Lumberjanes is twee. But it's adorably twee. That's what twee is. It's like adorably and hipstery and all those, that kind of thing. And it's like,
you're saying this is not that. This is trying so, this is like clunky twee. This is like dorky old dudes trying to be twee. That is how this feels to me.
I disagree. Twee is like Belle and Sebastian. This is not Belle and Sebastian.
So it's just it's a solid piece of literature then. That's what you're saying?
It's a fun, adventure-y, teen adventure. It's like a teen superhero book. It's exactly what I want out of Teen Titans. It's enjoyable. I like it. The art's great. I like the story. It keeps it moving. Bye. Don't know what you want out of Teen Titans book. Yes, it's dumb. Of course. There's not really many smart DC superhero comics. I'm just making one that isn't all about death and murder is fine with me.
And you know what? That's fine.
Are you a buy or you a do not buy, Eric?
You're just not happy unless you're talking over me.
What are you?
What am I?
What are you, a buy or do not buy?
You have to what decide. Is a man?
What is a man?
Is a miserable little pile of secrets. I'm a buy on this, but not because it's good.
What? What does that even mean?
I enjoy this book, but it is the guiltiest of guilty pleasures. It is retarded. The whole thing with like fucking Raven, it's like, oh, I'm dancing and there's magic. This is fucking dumber than shit. It just bugs me. I hate that I like it.
You're allowed to like things that are dumb. It's okay.
I know. I guess I like you.
That's true.
To be fair, you're very twee.
I'm really not that twee, honestly. I think you're misinformed about what Twee is.
I don't think I am.
So we're a double buy on Teen Titans number 3. Next up is Justice League number 35, written by Geoff Johns, Doug Mankey and Ivan Reese doing pencils, Keith Champagne marker, when Christian Alemi, Ray McCarthy, and Joe Prado doing the inks. Five inkers. That's five.
It takes a lot.
Brad Anderson doing colors, Carlos M. Mangual doing letters. I have the comic book itself is fine. It's okay. I have a very serious issue with this cover. This cover is bullshit. This cover is a fucking lie. This is DC lying to our faces. Because none of this shit happens in this comic book. None of that.
It's a long tradition of bullshit on the comic book covers.
I know, but I thought we were past that. Can't we just get a... God.
We never get past that.
But most of this is Bruce Wayne. Most of this entire comic is Bruce Wayne and Lex Luthor sniping at each other at a press conference, and them exploring Luthor's labs, and then, oh shit, there's a dude trying to kill everybody, and then, oh shit, something gets exploded in Luthor's labs, and then apparently what's on the cover happens next issue.
Like, that's what you do, right, is you put on the cover of what's in the next book, so you know to buy it.
I thought it was, you know, what's in this comic book is what's on the cover.
No, that's the way it works, is you read the cover last.
Is it? No, I think I usually do it first. Am I doing it backwards?
Oh, you're right. It's on the outside, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first thing you see when you buy a comic.
Oh,
you pick it up, you look, oh, look, it's the cover. And look, the cover is Batman with a mask on, you know, something to keep, like a gas mask or... something to, you know,
well, it's to cover up his kissable yowie lips.
Yeah, that's very true. There's like people, there's a hazmat teams and like a military SWAT team kind of looking guys behind him. He's holding, there's all the Justice League members are on the ground with like a hazy kind of fog on looking, kind of like poison or some kind of virus. There's a quarantine contaminated banner on the ground, and Flash is in his arms.
And they're
unconscious.
And they look into each other's eyes and they passionately kiss.
That'd be more interesting.
DC Yowie. There's a market for it. I swear.
There is a market for it. But guess what? None of that happens in this comic book. And
This cover's bullshit. Oh my God.
This cover is bullshit. Like, there's not even a hint of it. Like, why isn't the cover of this Luthor and Bruce Wayne? Why isn't the cover of this...
looking longingly into each other's eyes.
I'd like that more. It'd be more honest. And it's not... The issue itself is well-written enough, but...
it's not bad. DC is very dorky about their superheroes. Flash is literally getting ice cream for children.
Cyborg and Shazam, and Shazam wants hot dogs.
Shazam is fucking hilarious. I think I actually laughed out loud when he's like, I want a hot dog. Give me $5.
Yeah, he is a 12-year-old or something, you know.
Yeah, he's a 12-year-old idiot.
Yes. And but most of this issue is just Bruce and Lex passively aggressively like trying to outduel each other. And then, and Luthor's head grows and shrinks depending on what page he's on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a mood ring, isn't it?
I guess so. But.
He's gonna turn into the Watcher by the end of next book.
How much of this is like, I don't know, it just is the same thing we already knew. Mm. Like, this has been happening since the end of Forever Evil. With Lex and Bruce. And it's like 20 pages of that, and then something happens.
It does feel like a delay and like a nothing book, but for some reason, I mean, you say it, it's well written enough. How bad, how many of these books have we read that are just terrible? This is actually palatable, even though all the things that are, you know, quote unquote advertised don't happen in this book, that there's nothing really compelling to move it across, that I don't know. Why is this readable? And we've sat through so much garbage that, I don't know, events actually happen in.
We recently read Thor 1, which is kind of the same situation where they unveil the new Lady Thor at the very end. Mm-hmm. And I liked that because what do we learn about Lex Luthor or Bruce Wayne in this comic book that we didn't, did we learn anything new? Did they move any kind of plot along at all?
Well, I mean, of course, you could say, what in the hell can we learn about these characters? But I don't know. It feels like fresh air because everything has been fucking poisoned up till now.
I'll say it's not bad.
Yeah.
But I want to read the next issue, not this one. Because I read the solicitation and it said beginning in the Amazovirus. The Amazovirus? That's the name of it.
You saw that in the solicitation. You're like, ooh, I want to know about the Amazovirus.
Go look at all the other solicitations for DC, Eric.
Say no more. I'll take the Amazovirus. Good fucking God.
I just cared about the virus part. Like, I like the idea of the Justice League fighting something that's not necessarily, like, something they can punch.
Well, I want a fucking book about Shazam getting hot dogs.
I do. That's actually, I would
die. I know! It'd be hilarious!
It's only in, like, two panels in this comic, and those two panels are entertaining. That's another, like, it's like the Bruce and Lex show, where I'm more, like, the most entertaining characters in this are Cyborg and Shazam getting hot dogs.
I know. I wish it would happen.
So, and Aquaman on top of buildings like he's Batman for some reason. It makes no sense to me, but...
He's gonna call an orca from the top of a building.
I know. He's like,
Shamu!
He's practicing. I can't... It's not a bad comic book, but I'm more interested in the next one than this one. There's nothing in this that gave me any kind of... Aside from Shazam wanting hot dogs. Mm-hmm. But I can't recommend this. I have to say not buy.
It's probably safest to say do not buy, but... If someone, you know, puts a gun to your head and says, hey, you need to buy a Geoff Johns comic right now, this is not a terrible one.
I would suggest his Superman with John Romita Jr.
Well, that's a different thing.
So, we're a double do not buy. Justice League 35 covers bullshit.
Total bullshit, man.
Yeah. We're going to move over to Marvel, where... Dear God.
Are we going to read Sixes?
Yeah, we're going to read some Sixes.
Sixes!
This is Avengers and X-Men, Axis, number 2. They making sure that number 2 comes out right after number 1, so you don't lose interest too quickly.
Until you look at it, you're like, this is bullshit.
Written by Rick Remender, art by Adam Kubert, colors by Laura Martin and Matt Milla. Mia, one of the other letters by Chris Olopoulos. Continuing, this whole issue is pretty much like Iron Man's point of view and him trying to deal with. He's helped create these two adamantium super sentinels that are apparently like beaming people inside of them.
I don't understand what the fuck is happening. It's all of a sudden everyone flashes blue and then stuff happens.
I think that's what they explain.
Comic book is bullshit.
I think that's what they say.
What do you call them? Pym particles?
Yes, they get pimmed. They get pimmed inside of the adamantium super sentinels.
So wait a minute. Did someone pim their ride?
Go jump in the garbage can.
In the garbage can.
Go jump in a garbage can. That's terrible.
Was that joke bullshit?
not as much as bullshit as that Justice League cover. But this comic, this isn't very good.
No, it's not. It is really stupid. This is like heading into the climax of the worst Marvel event movie you've ever seen. It's like Guardians of the Galaxy or Avengers if they were really, really bad. That's what this is trying to be. It's like a pretty interesting and fun fight scene, but it's dumb as fuck. And there's more of that. They've got Axis at the top and bottom of the last page.
Mm-hmm. And then the first page, too.
That feels intentional. Why?
That's dumb. I don't know, but they're
really proud of their Sixus logo.
They really are. They're like, wow, look at this. Look what happens. It's just strange. I don't know. Rick Remender cannot write Tony Stark. I don't like his Tony Stark at all. I don't.
He's not Joss Whedon, and it feels to me like he's trying to write like the fucking Avengers. The Joss Whedon fucking movie. It's
yeah.
Ugh. It's. It's bad.
I don't.
I can hardly believe this is the same guy that wrote X-Force.
I don't know. I generally really like Rick Remender, and this, but I don't know. It's just. I'm getting flashbacks to Fraction writing Fear Itself, where you take a really great writer. And then you make them write something that doesn't seem right. I don't know. Because Fear Itself feels the same way, which, you know, Matt Fraction wrote. And Fraction's a great writer, generally. And it was pretty bad. And this is, I'm getting flashbacks.
Well, you know, every artist, any kind of artist, they get permission to lay a turd every so often. You can't expect everything just to knock it out of the park. It's impossible. But
I just don't see where this is going to go to make it.
I can't figure out why it's as bad as it is.
It's because it just jumps in. I don't know. Like, it feels so odd to me that we've had two issues and it's just all they are is a giant fight with
Red. Yeah.
Giant Red Skull.
Oh, I mean, I don't mean like I don't know how to criticize it.
No, but I mean,
God knows we're extra good at that. But yeah. I'm trying to figure out someone that I like and respect. How can he write something this off base that's this bad?
Well, I think you kind of pinpointed it. Like, I don't know if he's actually trying to go like, oh, I'm going to try and write like Joss Whedon.
Mm-hmm.
But all his books that I really like are, I don't know, more cerebral.
Yeah.
And it's more about choices. Like, Uncanny X-Force was so good, not necessarily because, you know, sure there was quips. I mean, Deadpool was in the book.
Yeah.
But all the climactic things were about someone choosing to do this instead of something else. Something that shown something about their character. This is just kind of empty. Mm. You know, I'm not going like, oh wow, Tony Stark. That's something new about his character. It's an event comic. I understand it's not good, but I think the best event comics, like Infinity, like they showed something deeper.
Mm-hmm. But it feels pretty obvious that they're not going to reveal anything. They're not going to change anything really dramatic. They're not really, I mean, nothing earth-shattering is going to come out of this. This is just a big, gross, dumb fight scene. This is dumb punching.
Yeah, it's, I think, the same kind of reasons we didn't like going back to Sinister Core War,
mm-hmm.
where it's like a big event, but it's just punching.
Yeah.
Hey, look, lots of punching. Hey, look, 40 characters on the page. You can't really see what's going on.
I will say that the preview of the little Neil Francis U pencils of those Sentinels,
mm-hmm.
they looked pretty fucking sweet. But
yeah.
st- still, I think we've talked enough about how bad this book is.
Yeah, do not buy.
Yeah, don't buy this goddamn book.
Next up, Death of Wolverine, number 4, last issue of the series, miniseries, where we, spoiler warning, Wolverine dies. Crazy, huh?
Jesus Christ, now you tell me.
Now I tell you.
This cover is bullshit. There is never a guy with a skeleton face carrying him around. They pour metal on him. That's what happens.
Well, Eric, now you see it. Now you understand. I'm glad you've gotten where I was. You see the process. It's written by Charles Soule, pencils by Steve McNiven, Jay Leeston doing inks, Justin Ponsor on colors, Chris Olopoulos doing the letters. This is basically seeing Wolverine with like rebar claws strapped to the back of his hands, going back to fight Weapon X Doctor, whatever the hell his name is. Cornelius something or other.
Of course his name is Cornelius.
Yeah, it's an evil doctor name. Mm-hmm. I think they reserve that name exclusively for evil doctors. But he's developing, obviously, he's developing, you know, continuing to develop the same stuff that he did to Wolverine, to Logan. And Logan basically sacrifices himself to save these people that are being experimented on and make sure Cornelius dies.
He fights the coffin.
Fights the coffin?
The guy looks like the coffin.
Oh, right. He does.
He's glowing.
Yeah. I actually kind of like the design.
Yeah, it's fun. It's neat.
For a little one-shot, you know, super soldier kind of idea that Wolverine has to fight. But, you know, I know Wolverine's going to be back.
Yeah.
It's not a secret. I think everyone realizes that. I think everyone's just kind of... I'm glad that we're going to get a break. I think when someone's gone for a couple, a character's gone for a year or two, you get appreciate them more when they come back. It means something. And lets all the books that have him in them, they can be, you know, freshen up a little bit with new blood. But do you think this is like, I don't know, dramatic enough did the death, because I mean, it's coming, you know, it's coming. Did the death meet your expectations?
It's hard to say really what would have met my expectation.
Right.
I don't know, man. I don't really know what I would want in the death of Wolverine. Whether I care if this is poignant enough or I don't know. I don't know how I feel about. I guess it just feels so empty that it's hard for me to like really develop emotions around it. Strong feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, what does it mean when a comic book character dies? Like, I genuinely felt something when we were reading Fantastic Four and Johnny Storm died.
Right.
Like, that was like, wow, it really felt like something. And they fooled me for a second into thinking, oh, shit. Comic book characters actually die. Oh, wait, no, they don't. This doesn't quite do that. It's an interesting enough moment. It's, you know, it ties the adamantium back. It's what kills him. It's what's made him so powerful. I don't quite know what they're trying to say there. I don't want to waste a lot of brain power thinking about it. I don't know. It doesn't work like a good superhero death story. It's not horrible. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It is beautiful.
It's a great looking page. The page that he dies on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really beautiful. The colors are done really well. It's a pretty epic setting. It's kind of hard to give a shit. It's kind of hard to really feel anything, which if you're not getting some kind of catharsis from it, it's not doing its job, and I'm not. It feels... Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, I understand what thematically, I think you hinted at that, they're thematically what they're going for with the adamantium and tying it back together to the original Weapon X project and, you know, him basically sacrificing himself so that there aren't more people like him.
Mm-hmm.
So that there aren't people who have to go through the torture that he's gone through. And I understand that, but there's the same problem with that is that you don't know who these people are. Like, yes, you can see them look terrified, like being strapped down in these operating chambers or whatever, but you don't know who these people are. You don't really have that much connection to them. The only way you can kind of have any empathy for them at all is kind of projecting Logan onto them. I don't know. It's hard to get any kind of ties to them with just a couple pages of being them being lab subjects. I mean, yes, there's natural empathy for just a human who's, you know, being tortured. But when we're, you know, the character's Wolverine has been around for 40 years now. And you think there is I think the even bigger question is, do you think there's a way to end this that's not, like, somewhat disappointing? I mean, like, not, does it live, could possibly live up to your best expectations?
And that's, like, that's what I was saying. I don't know how to do it better. I don't know what would satisfy me. Because I think Wolverine at his best is one of my favorite comic characters. I feel like you fall on that line as well. There are a lot of people absolutely. That hate Wolverine. I've always loved him. I've always thought he was great. I was thinking about this earlier. I had an airbrushed t-shirt with Wolverine on it. When I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that make a lot of sense?
It does make a lot of sense.
I don't know. It just feels sort of hollow to me. It just doesn't quite work.
That being said, I think I'm still a buy on it.
Yeah, that's a lot of criticism. You should probably still buy it.
I think at the end of the day, what we're really saying is that it does a very difficult thing, probably as well as can be expected, given only 4 issues to kind of lead up to it. I think that with a four issue miniseries about a death of a character that's been around for so long and has been unkillable, like Charles Soule has not written any of the lead ups to this, he's not written any kind of Wolverine titles or anything like that. He hasn't had. He's basically just had to. I mean, they've been leading, you know, he's lost his healing factor, he's gained armor, you know, they've been doing steps along the way to show him being vulnerable and stuff like that, but reading this alone, you're only getting what Charles Soule has written, and I think that in this 4-issue arc, I think he's done as much as you possibly can, and Steve McNiven is drawing it, and it's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, Death of Wolverine number 4, that is a double buy. I don't know how much of those legacy books we're going to be reading because I really am not that interested in reading about. Hey, look, these people are sad. Maybe the Storm book. That might be interesting.
Yeah, Storm's always interesting.
Other than that, eh. Next up, Ms. Marvel number 9. We both are going to be reading it anyway, so we might as well talk about it.
That's what I say about everything.
Even though I think at the end of the day, we just end up going, hey, this book's amazing. You guys should read it.
It's got a doggy.
It does have Lockjaw. I love that, you know, him rolling around on his back and her, like, sitting on him.
Yeah, that's weird. That's super strange.
That one's cute. Lockjaw's cute. But
Carl Winslow has made another appearance in this book.
He has. Yeah, G. Willow Wilson writing, Adrian Alfano on art, Ian Herring doing colors, and Joe Caragmagna on the letters. We see Kamala kind of be beamed up to the Inhuman mothership, or to their new city. And we kind of get a little bit of insight into her powers, where she fits into the Inhumans, all that. She finally learns that she actually is an Inhuman. But I think it's very interesting that they go from that to her at her family's house, with her actual parents. And I think that's an interesting dichotomy they present of the, you know, Medusa as her inhuman matriarch, and then she gets her real parents. And both of them caring about her in a different, in very different ways. But she's continuing her pursuit of the inventor. There's kind of a very interesting fight between her and this giant robot thing. And there's actually a little bit of a... I think this book does a good job of doling out, like, good cliffhangers. Good little bits at the end to keep you reading.
I don't even notice because I'm not gonna not devour it. Everything about it delights me.
Yeah.
Admittedly, I am really intrigued by the end of this book. I feel like it's been so long. How many issues has it been? God, comics happen in, like, such strange time dilation.
9 issues.
Yeah, but how long has it been since we saw the parrot guy?
Oh, like 4?
Yeah, it feels like 100 years.
It's been almost like nothing.
I know. It's ridiculous. I like this story. She manages to... I don't know. These characters are all very interesting and lively. I think probably the least interesting thing in the whole book is Medusa. The character that normally is very interesting and likable, but I don't know. She's just a little bit of a... I don't know if I'd call her a plot device. She's just supposed to be kind of an other, I think. Everyone else is just jumping off the page.
I think she is a authority figure, and I think...
Yeah.
I think every authority figure in this book is like... There is either the authority figure that is the other...
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the people who are kind of on the same page as Kamala, her age group, or someone who is kind of with her. And I think I think she writes that purposefully so that mm-hmm. I think she, to keep the teen feel of the book.
I think that makes a lot of sense because I think the feeling around Medusa is similar to like the Imam in the earlier issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, how she comes in and she's like, well, these are the rules and this, and you're going to do this and you're going to live in Adelon and you're going to do these things. And you know, in the end, she rebels against Medusa and leaves, does whatever the fuck she wants.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's to show that it's not necessarily that being a superhero, it's not the superhero thing is the, what's, I don't know, the governing factor. It's not like, oh, authority figure that's a superhero. Like, she respected and listened to Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because he didn't give her, like, you can't do this, you can't do that. He didn't try and give her rules. And she's, at the end of the day, she's still a teenager. And I think that's what I really liked about those issues, those two Wolverine issues,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, Wolverine has been, he's like, him and young female, you know, he's a mentor to a lot of young female characters throughout the years. And even in those two issues, you could see some of that of him not trying to set rules on her, just saying, you know, this is what I've learned. And
yeah.
And a teenager, that's how you more likely to reach a teenager than necessarily trying to give them rules. But yeah, this book is... It's charming. So charming and beautiful and well written.
It'll charm the burkini right off you.
Yeah. It's great. We're a double buy. I think we'll probably just be a double buy forever, but you know, I don't get tired of saying it.
I think I just have to say this because I want to see your reaction.
Okay.
I think one of my single favorite things in this book is when they're like scouting the house, and they're like on the hill, like looking out mm-hmm. over like binoculars, and the mm-hmm. kid and the other kid, instead of binoculars, has a fucking cheeseburger. And he's like he's looking into a cheeseburger. It's so stupid.
I think that it really encompasses teenagers.
Yeah.
Like, just like, Yeah, Kamala's like serious, like trying to scout. And he's just like
eating McDonald's on a pile of garbage. Yeah,
he's like, I gotta eat. Gotta eat.
Oh man, that's so funny.
But yeah, Ms. Marvel number 9, double buy.
Buy it so hard.
Yeah, if you're not reading it already, you go get them all. The first trade just came out. So
I know I'll probably buy it because I need to own it in duplicate.
Yes, of course.
Anything I like is worth buying twice.
Yeah, that's how comics get you. Yeah, it's like, hey.
Well, fuck you every time.
Here's a different way to read it. It's a different way. Buy it again.
I've heard that that was how Charles Dickens made his money.
He's the godfather of serialization.
Yeah.
He's the first one. First and still the hallmark. I mean, I think Matt Fraction, one of his tenets for people who write comics, he's like, go read Dickens.
That's what he did.
Because he did it first, really. I mean, there were people behind him, but he's the first who like commercially did it successfully.
Yeah, he did it really. He was a really smart businessman, apparently.
Yeah, he was. He's one of those few authors who were successful while they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And from that time period. Our last book of the week is our indie book of the week. It is Wild's End, number 2.
I'm so glad it's this book.
Created by Dan Abnett, I.N.J. Colbard. Written by Dan Abnett. Illustrated and lettered by I.N.J. Colbard. Additional material by Nick Vincent with both Abnett and Colbard.
I just want to say that this cover is bullshit. There are no postcards in this book.
Feels like you're trying to make fun of me, Eric.
What? No.
No, you're not trying to make fun of me?
I'm just a fan of postcards.
Mm-hmm. But we read the first issue. We both really liked it a lot. And so I decided we'll check in with the second issue, see how it goes. And it's still really good. Really
Winnie
really
the Pooh
wonderful.
Meets War of the Worlds.
Yeah, this Hound character is...
He's great. Every character is great.
Yeah, they're all really good.
I really like every single character. They're all quirky for the sake of not just being quirky. I don't know. It works really well. I really want to know if Rabbit's dead, whatever his damn name is.
Yeah.
I'm really dying to know.
Gilbert. Yeah. This cat, female cat writer.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interested. Very much of a... This time period especially, like, she reminds me of so many authors that I studied in college that were much like this.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, so.
I just thought that there was, like, just the one famously so, you know, the whose name I can't remember.
What, reclusive female writer? Or modernist?
That, like, she dressed as a man and all that shit.
There's a few different, she mixes matches a couple different, like there's notable character traits of several female authors
mm-hmm.
of what, you know, World War One, you know, kind of Victorian era.
It was Edwardian.
Late Victorian or Edwardian. That the modernist time period is like
1990
to like 1930. Okay. So.
So you're kind of talking about a different thing.
Well, sort of, but her.
You're talking. Yes, you're talking about a greater literary movement, not just
Yes,
this is set in Edwardian England, but that time period is part of what you're describing.
Yes, precisely. But yeah, this entire thing is.
This book has talking cats in it.
It does have talking cats in it. It also has talking dogs and rabbits and pigs, mm-hmm. but
and aliens.
The robot aliens, at least so far. We haven't seen any biological entities. I assume there are some, but somewhere. But it's really interesting. It says 2 of 6 on the front cover. I'm a little upset. There's only going to be 6 issues of it.
I just felt myself die a little bit.
But maybe you know, maybe there'll be another chapter, another, you know, six issues down the line if it does well enough. But I really like it. I'm anticipating the next issue greatly.
I like
There's too many good comics out.
Oh, that's true. This one will continue to get my money.
Yes.
I like it tremendously.
Yeah, a lot of great personality and very interesting mix of genres, and the characters, despite being animals, feel very natural and interesting. Buy it. Wild's Ed number 2, buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Let there be more. Not let there be blood, let there be more.
Let there be more blood.
Well, that too. There probably will be in this book, even though yeah, they haven't seen much of it.
There's going to be a shitload of dead piggies.
Oh, that poor little...
Auntie! Where's my auntie?
That's a terrible accent.
I can't do it, so I just didn't bother.
Oh.
Okay, so I think that'll bring this week of Weekly Floppies to a close. No, Eric's upset. You can hear it in his voice.
Oh.
But with that, we will jump to our last segment of the week, and that is Nerd Boy Book Club. 4 words should get you very excited.
I know, I'm really crazy excited.
This week we are reading Fatale Volumes 1 through 5 by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. As evidenced by the title, Nerd Boy Book Club is a segment where we will...
read books?
Yeah.
And nerd books. Out about them.
Yeah. There, Eric can describe it better than I can.
That, I have skills.
Yeah, it's because I got that.
It's because I drank that smoothie. It's brain food.
That is. It is brain food. Yeah, this Fatale is... Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips have done lots of work together, and that right after this was finished, they started doing the Fade Out, which we have read the first issue previously on this podcast. We had not read any issues of Fatale at all during this whole run, and I kind of did that purposely because I really felt it was more worthy of a longer form discussion after it was all finished than trying to dissect one issue at a time, because I think you lose some of the greater...
No, I would not want to read this in any other format.
Yeah.
To release this monthly is just kind of ridiculous. Some things work so much better as a novel format.
Mm-hmm.
This works just fine that way. I would hate reading this monthly.
Yeah, it's basically like a Lovecraftian noir story centered around the femme fatale of the title, as she basically this woman who we follow her through from basically the 30s up till today, and she doesn't seem to age, and she seems to be able to make men do anything she wants unless they have certain protections on them. Otherwise, they see her and they fall in love and are willing to do anything for her. She becomes their life. And it really is kind of an exploration of the idea of the femme fatale to a certain extent. I have read the first two trades of this. I had owned 3 and 4. Five just came out very recently. After I read 1 and 2, I figured we'd end up doing this book club. I started saving them basically so I could read them all in one chunk. This is all fresh to you, right, Eric? You hadn't read any of this before?
I didn't even know what the story was about. It was barely on my radar.
Give me your general impression.
I think that to call it just a noir,
mm-hmm.
it goes beyond just that simple sort of genre story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more than that. I mean, it's a pretty big story. I'm going to end up going all over the place.
That's fine. It's
it starts out. A small, seeming like a much smaller story than it is.
Right.
And it really grows to be something very, very different. I was not predicting where it was going. I mean, you have a pretty good idea where it's going to end towards the end, you know,
right.
as you're coming up to it, like, yeah, this and this and this is going to happen. And then it more or less does. But at the beginning, it is, not even close. Like, you think, well, this person is this character and this is this character, and it just, it is not what you expect at all. You know, most of these noir stories, the femme fatale is not the main character, and she's very much the main character. The two stories that I would compare this to, she's like Morpheus in The Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
Or she's like the Doctor in Doctor Who, which
yes.
is, you know, what The Sandman is based on. It occurred to me really clearly when, what was it, book 3 or 4? That's the collection of the stories of her when she's younger. Yeah. The Ye Olde books.
That's 3. Yeah.
Yeah. It felt exactly like a collection of Sandman short stories.
Different iterations mm-hmm. of the Fatale.
Yeah. It was really bizarre to read, and it felt sort of out of context with this, but it sort of made me understand, like, a little bit more, I don't know, the kind of story he was trying to tell, the kind of character he was trying to make. It still just felt, I don't, like an outlier, I don't know, artificial, strange to me, but not bad. I didn't regret reading them.
Brubaker has come out and said, you know, that he always had those in mind, those mm-hmm. stories of older, you know, from the dark ages, middle ages, whatever yeah. you want to call them, and from different time periods. Putting it in the middle there after, I think it works well in that the first two stories that it, you know, it does time jumps. The first one, they're organized roughly in there's 5 books, and that each one roughly does encompass a different era. Except for that third one, which jumps around a lot more. Even though there is an overarching kind of frame narrative involving that's set in present day,
mm-hmm.
which is present in all the books. But the third book, I think, serves as a way to kind of disrupt your expectations a little bit.
Yeah,
because you just go, oh, the first one's set in like the '50s, and the second one's set in like the '70s, but the third one just suddenly, oh, it's 700 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're just, oh, well, I think it...
That's unexpected.
Yeah, it serves to disrupt. You go, like, I don't know what to expect. Like, to try and... And I think it also works that it sets up a larger scope in that, which it otherwise would be impossible to cover. Like, trying to... He can jump around the decades of this century, and that's easily identifiable. Like, you do a 50s story, you go, and a 70s story, and a 90s story, and so on and so forth. Like, it's easier to set stories in that time period, but it doesn't give you the scope of hundreds of years of this happening. It seems like you mentioned, like, in The Sandman, where you get an idea of The Sandman has always existing and will always exist. Sort of like this sort of gives it that sort of idea of timelessness, of infinity. And I think it also enhances the kind of the dread you feel for her, especially when that the sequence where she is committing suicide
mm-hmm.
over, oh, and God. Over and over again.
That tugged at the heartstrings. Like, I think at that point she has, like, you're really not quite sure whether she's sympathetic in those moments or not, because she's very monstery.
Yeah.
She doesn't mean to be. It's just sort of her nature. She's just sort of accidentally a monster.
Yeah.
And she can be pretty genuinely horrible. But then you see that and you're like, oh my God, that is brutal. It really tugs at you. It's incredibly effective.
Well, I think that's a statement that there's a nuance there that you don't necessarily, she's not just a very super easily sympathetic character. but that you do end up feeling sorry for, because you get, as the story goes on, you get a better idea of that time, of the effect she has on, that she doesn't have real relationships with anyone. Like I like those friendships she develops with we get in that the Wild West era story with that character, that she develops that friendship with the Indian, the Native American, mm-hmm. that tracks her, and that is echoed later on when in the last story where she has a friendship with that librarian character. Both of them who aren't under her spell, who are not entranced by her or enchanted by her, however you want to describe it. But they stick around her despite the fact that she doesn't control them. And you can see that the importance of those friendships to her, the fact that she rarely has any kind of relationships with men that she can actually trust.
Yeah, it's kind of her only opportunity to be a human being.
Yes. We had read that Fade Out issue, and you would like the art in it, the Sean Phillips.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the art in this as a whole?
It's very strong. There are some times where I think that it's a bit overdone or a bit overworked, or you know, something about the pouty lips is a little bit corny.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the end, it's a hell of a book, and it adds a lot of mood and atmosphere, and most of the time, it's really knocked out of the park. It's beautiful. It's really great. I think Fuck Pearl Jam is my favorite line in the whole book.
Yes, there is the fourth volume involves her basically hanging out in this house, enchanting pretty much every male member of this mm-hmm. kind of washed up grunge band, and it reminded me actually of Point Break a little bit, because you get these like rock stars who rob banks and like are killing people, and even though they actually even kill anyone. Because she makes that one dude drown himself in the toilet.
Yeah, yeah, I'm right there right now.
But we haven't really tackled who she's facing. Like what? There's this Joe. This femme fatale is seemingly immortal and seemingly, you know, like impossible to kill.
Mm-hmm.
But she's running for pretty much the entirety of this story from this cult like these. Cthulhu, these cultists that worship the ancient gods, the eldritch horrors of Lovecraftian mythos and lore. Did you find them compelling villains? They go to some pretty ludicrous lengths to make you really hate them. I mean, especially near the end with the stringing up of the babies. Dear Lord.
I think it's like manipulation at that point. That and the way that the drawing was done. It felt like the artist didn't actually look up pictures of dead babies. They all looked like just babies.
Like, well, I think at that point those babies are still alive.
They looked alive. I didn't know what in the hell they were trying to communicate.
Well, I think that at that point you're supposed to. I think they're communicating that they're alive at that point because they come back to that same place later, and then they're just withered up, like bodies.
Yeah,
that have been there for who knows how long, but. I think the implication is that they just hung the babies up there and then they starved to death. That's what I gathered from it. Which is grim.
It's fairly grim, yes.
Fairly grim. But, I mean, they torture and murder and sacrifice and kill everyone in their way. I honestly, of the femme fatale herself, Jo, do you think she is the most interesting character in this story? I think that's what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, well, she's kind of the only character, and like, there's little tiny snippets of characters that revolve around her. It's. I'm not gonna say that they're empty, but she definitely has the most depth, the most interesting things going on. that you learn about her through other people's eyes, I think.
Yeah.
That's sort of, they're all props in her story.
Yeah. And the fact that she does basically enchant every man that looks at her,
mm-hmm.
it makes it kind of repetitive that, you know, their stories all are the same kind of track. And I mean, I understand, and that really just kind of just does emphasize the fact that they are just kind of props to tell her story. The best male character in this is the one she's kind of, I don't know if they're actually married or the detective in the very first story, the first book.
He was a journalist.
No. Not the one she's actually.
Oh,
with.
Yeah. The one that she meets during World War II.
The World War II guy. Yeah. I actually liked him. I felt him the most interesting.
Well, he's the most flawed.
Yeah.
You know, he's maligned as the crooked cop, and we see him like he's on a decline, and he sort of sets the tone for, she's sort of going through a period of her life where she's starting these relationships with men, and it seems to be making a statement about, well, she's watching them grow older and they're getting sicker, and she feels so sorry for them because they have to do that. But it feels like that at first, but it's more like they're just so enthralled by her. She feels just, I don't know, it's pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I never really got that sense from him, though.
Well, I think what intrigued me most about him is that it seems most of these other, all these other guys don't understand what she is.
Yeah.
They just follow her because they can't not.
Yes.
But he, you know, him being, you know, saving her from these occultists and in World War II from Nazis and getting a piece of that magic book, to call it that is as simplistic as possible, but to him in understanding magic, to understand what all that stuff means and still kind of engaging in it, and I think the him kind of debating about selling her out to the cultist for him to live longer, him debating over that kind of the war inside of him.
Yeah,
I think that was the thing that drew me to him. I thought that was interesting, where it seems like a lot of the male characters who are like are just props to try and mm-hmm. to show what, you know, that she can't have real relationships for the most part. Like a lot of these men she does love, or at least loves to a certain extent.
Yes,
but she never knows if any of it is real, simply because of what she does to them, even without her trying. They just see her like that. The story of the landscaper, where, you know, she is purposely living a secluded life, purposely never going out, having like basically a maid or a nanny or, you know, this helper lady who lives with her and gets her groceries. And yet a landscaper, you know, catches her through the windows one day, and then suddenly he sleeps in his truck every night, just hoping to get a glimpse of her from the street without her even knowing about it. I thought that was a very interesting detail, in which that he's not even a very, like, that's all we know about him, honestly. Mm-hmm. But that alone informs you of what her life is like of men, like when she couldn't control her power, of men murdering each other just because she's in their presence, and how, and I, like you said, like it, I don't, it'd be, I think that's one of the reasons I waited for all this to be collected for us to read it. Because it does work a lot better as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
you are more informed about her struggle and her as a character than you would be if you read an issue or five issues even. It is intriguing, but like I read the first two trades, like they are very intriguing, but all as a whole, it really informs her character entirely. Well, you had briefly mentioned the ending earlier about knowing what was going to happen. Were you satisfied by that ending? Did it?
Well, it didn't seem like it was going to go any other way.
Yeah.
That in the end, I don't know. It feels like a pretty naturalistic ending to watch her grow old and die.
Right.
That she gets her just desserts for feeling really bad about being a monster.
Like you said, it's very reminiscent of Sandman to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Where Morpheus just, he knows what's coming and he just faces it. And this is very similar in that way. And like, it's kind of breaking a cycle of a that's gone on for centuries, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, like, I think that's another reason that those tales from, you know, the old, from different time periods are there, is to add to that kind of feeling of that catharsis at the end of her, of you feel a little bit more because of the time, of the weight of time pressing down on this story. It seems like it's just an endless chase of these cultists trying to find this Fatale. Do you think that they never really explain exactly what she is?
There's something interrelated, you know, whatever it is that that created what's his name? I don't even remember. Whatever it is that created him, whatever he is, whatever these old ones are.
The cult leader.
Yeah. Whatever these Lovecraftian monsters is the same source of whatever it is that she does.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes me think, like, when she, like, her dancing drives all those people to whips them all into a sexual frenzy, and she fucks the songwriter, and he writes a song, and it's got some of her magic in it, and everyone that hears the song, it changes them.
Right.
And the book that the Godfather, whatever his name is, I can't remember names.
Nicholas.
Yeah. Was Nicholas the Godfather?
Oh, you mean the father of Nicholas?
The Godfather of Nicholas.
Not Godfather of Nicholas. Oh, what is his name?
His father was a character. His father went insane.
Yes, his father's in the insane asylum.
Yeah, but his Godfather was the writer from the beginning of the story.
The journalist, yeah.
The journalist, that's right. But regardless of all that, he wrote that first novel, and it contained like these little magical bits of like her muse, and they had to remove them to publish the book.
Right. Otherwise there'd be chaos. Yeah.
Yes. I thought that was really interesting. And I think that the fact that pretty much everything I've just said is really just conjecture. It's just, it's theories. It's not necessarily true. That kind of enhances this, that it doesn't say one way or the other, but it's interesting.
I think that's where I lie as well. I feel the same way, that I think it toes that line very well, that it gives you a little bit of detail about where she comes from and what she is and why these cultists are after her and how they talk about her the last iteration of her and what happened when they captured her and killed her, sacrificed her, or whatever. They mm-hmm. don't even really spell that out specifically. Right. But it was the earthquake in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The great earthquake in the early 1900s. That, you know, they say nearly, you know, set broke off part of the country, et cetera, et cetera. But mm-hmm. it just gives you a little bit of hints about, you know, why they chase her. And even at the ending, it kind of gives you even more of that. And it kind of spells out maybe she has broken that cycle of these two forces trying to conquer each other. And yet they're very tied together, but you get enough to fill in the blanks yourself and not, you know, it's like that old kind of theory about horror movies and like that the scariest things are the things you don't see.
Oh yeah.
And that once, and a lot of horror movies, you know, make the mistake of showing you too much. And then when you finally see it, you're not as scared as what you imagine is always scarier than what they actually end up showing you, generally. And this is the same way. Like, the details you fill in yourself can color the world more interesting than necessarily if they try to spell it out precisely. Can you think, I think this is a truly unique kind of story in comic books, especially. There's a lot of noir that's been done in comics. Especially, I mean, from these two themselves, Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, they've written tons of kind of crime and noir detective stories and stuff like this. But this kind of horror and Lovecraftian, and mm-hmm. especially with a female main character.
You can count probably on, you know, 2.5 hands how many books there are with female lead characters.
Yeah, so... That alone, I think that makes this a really interesting and kind of an achievement almost.
Oh yes,
I think the main question that I think this book raises: you think it's successful in creating, like, making the main character make her nuanced enough? Do you think that it succeeds at that?
Nuanced enough.
Yeah, making it not just like, I think the criticism you could raise of this, if you wanted to, you want to play devil's advocate,
mm-hmm.
is that it goes, oh, well, I'm just gonna write, oh, it's just a detective story, but with the female is the main character, and you know, she's the all the men are the disposable ones. But it's not necessarily, it's just a reversal of that trope.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it surpasses that kind of question? I think it does.
I mean, it is a very big story. It is a very good story. I don't know. I think that's a strange criticism to make of it.
Well, I think that's the only thing I could.
Well, I mean, I think you can tell a pretty good story simply by turning a trope on its head.
No, that's very true.
This is something that you and I have discussed, but I don't know. I think it's more complicated than that. It's very artful. I think to try and boil it down to something simple doesn't quite do it justice. So,
well, I think that answers the question.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. I don't like to answer things straightforwardly.
So, yes, it succeeds.
You don't
cotton to that kind of answering?
Sure.
I try and work in that kind of, the cotton. I don't cotton to that.
You were trying to ever since you went to Stone Mountain, huh?
I think that's it. I went to George. I went to Stone Mountain. That's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you want to touch on, Eric? Anything else you think we should discuss?
Nothing's jumping out at me. We've covered a lot. Kind of gone from A to Z on this.
I think we always do the would you recommend this?
This is a book that I think a lot of people should read.
Mm-hmm.
You really come away with it, like, I don't know, like, I, somewhere, like, between some kind of catharsis and needing a shower.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I think that's the best noir stories are kind of.
Yeah.
Are kind of like that. It's like James Ellroy novels, like L.A. Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
It's that same kind of feeling where you go, you feel like the good guys have won, but at what cost? I think that's generally,
right.
You know, you, there's carnage.
Well, for me, she's the good guy, but she's really kind of not.
No.
Like, she's very compelling, but I also kind of hate her.
Well, I think she hates herself.
Yeah.
I think that's.
No, I definitely get that.
Yeah.
But it's very rich.
Yeah. It's, I think I would recommend it to more people just because it subverts that male dominated noir trope so much. I think I would not recommend noir to or horror comics either, because it is that kind of blend of both those genres. I would recommend it to people who necessarily wouldn't enjoy either of those things. I think because it subverts it so much, they would enjoy it because it's different than what you expect, especially after, you know, that first book catches you by a little by surprise.
It definitely does. You expect one thing, you get something really different.
It's kind of delightful to be surprised like that. It probably is. I think that can wrap us up for the week.
Feel pretty wrapped.
So, folks, next week we are doing Orkstein by The Stoko.
The Stoko.
Yeah. I kind of generally love a book that is mostly about orc penises.
Graunch.
Yep. Oh my god.
He got Graunch. That's Stoko's Twitter. He got Graunch.
That's amazing.
Stoko's pretty good.
So
I can't believe someone else didn't get it.
Yes. Orkstein, guys. One trade. First trade in comic stores near you. So read it. With that, we will come to a close. We are the Handsome Boys Comics. How are you? You can find us on. I'm breaking. I'm just repeating myself.
Breathy.
Yeah. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. You can like us, subscribe, rate us, all those things. Give us nice reviews. All those things really help us get new listeners, and we really appreciate it. Appreciate if you tell your friends, read about comics, spread the word. We like every new listener. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/HandsomeBoysComicsHour. We're on Twitter at HBCHour. You can email us, handsomeboyscomics@gmail.com. You can find me, Robbie, on Twitter at MixerMasterCereal. It's MixerCereal. Eric, where can they find you online?
They can see my portfolio by going to freewillunlimited.com. They can see most of the things I do online by going to ericzgoodnight.com, and they can tweet at me. I'm looking at Twitter right now. So live tweet me at Mr. Bad Example, spelled MR Bad Example.
Yeah, you guys want to get on some of the Inktober stuff, you better follow him.
Mm-hmm. Follow me so much.
Get to see him drawing me as an orc.
Yep. And drawing his D&D character.
And my D&D character, my kobold asshole.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's his actual class. He's not a warlock. He's just a kobold asshole.
He's an asshole, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That makes good sense to me.
It does. But with that, I think we will wrap it up. Oops, pop in there. Pop, pop!
Pop, pop.
Have a good one.
Rock and roll.